Okay, we quit in the middle of Numbers 13. And if you remember, Numbers 13 and 14 are really one big long story. And this is the capstone rebellion after chapter 10, right? In chapter 11, the rebellion start. We have two in chapter 11, one in chapter 12. So it's three. And then in 13, this is the fourth one, and this is the worst one. Okay, so they finally have made it to Canaan, or, you know, just south of Canaan, and they're supposed to go in and conquer the land in the first, well, at the beginning of chapter 13, that's where they were. And so before they do that, they send out spies. They send out 12 spies. Okay, and we talked about last time that if you read Deuteronomy 1, it was really the people's idea to send out the spies, and God gives instructions on how to do that in Numbers 13. The only two spies that are really significant are Caleb and Joshua, right? Because in chapter 14, the other 10 die, so they're done.
Because they lied?
Yes.
And God knew it.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, we'll get there today, hopefully. I mean, I think we'll get through 14. So they go up to spy out the land. Moses gives them more specific instructions. They're to see what the land is like and the people are like and the fortifications and all that kind of stuff. And we talked about last time how in Deuteronomy 1, it says that God is angry with Moses. So we're trying to figure out why God is angry with Moses. My theory, possibly, okay, is that in Numbers 17 through 20, he gives the spies the option of bringing back a bad report. There should have been no option of a bad report. God had already told them what the land was like. It was flowing with milk and honey. He had already told them that there were inhabitants in the land. That shouldn't have been a surprise either. Okay, God had already said there are people there. The land is good. So it might be okay that they go out and check it out. Maybe where should we attack first? You know, where are the best areas? Whatever, that's fine. But verse 19, how is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? Right? There should have been no option that the land is bad. Now, to be fair to the spies, they don't bring a report back that the land is bad. Okay, they do come back and say that the land is good. Verse 23 of chapter 13, right, they could bring back grapes and figs and pomegranates. Okay, so that's where we ended. So can someone read for me, please, Numbers 13, verses 25 to 33.
Indeed, it is flowing with milk and honey, and here is some of its fruit. However, the people living in the land are strong, and the cities are large and fortified. We also saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites are living in the land of the Negev. The Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live by the sea along the Jordan. Then Caleb quieted the people in the presence of Moses and said, "We must go up and take possession of the land, because we can certainly conquer it." But the men who had gone up with him responded, "We can't go up against these people because they are stronger than we are." So they gave a negative report to the Israelites about the land that they had scouted. "The land we passed through to explore is one that devours its inhabitants, and all the people we saw in it are men of great size. Even when the Nephilim there, the descendants of Anak, came from Nephilim, to ourselves we seemed like grasshoppers. We must have seen the same to them."
Okay, so the spies bring back their report. They've done all their spying, 40 days. Last week we drew a map on the board, right? And 40 days is enough time to go all the way up to north, past the Sea of Galilee to the northern part of Israel and come back. Okay, and like I said before, we don't know the exact route. And if they split up, you know, we're in groups of two or three or whatever and split up and divided up the land. But they had 40 days to go and come back. Okay. Verse 26, they proceed to come to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregations of the son of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. If you remember our map, Kadesh was the very south in the Negev. Okay, that's where Israel is right now before they're supposed to invade the land. Okay, they brought back word to them, to all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told them, We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey. Okay, so they bring back their report, show the food, and they start with the good. Okay, they do at least start with the good. That the land is exactly like God said. It is flowing with milk and honey. But notice what they say. Verse 27, it says, we went into the land where you sent us. The spies claim no ownership of the land. They don't even say our land. They don't say we went into the land God promised to give us. No, it's Moses. This is the land you sent us into. It's almost as if they're washing their hands of it. Right,
yeah.
Right. You sent us in there, okay, into this land. We went to the land where you sent us. It's not our land, not the promised land, not, you know, God's land.
Did they know that that was their promised land?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, they knew. I mean, this was the whole purpose of leaving Egypt, was to go to Canaan,
yeah.
Right? That was, God was going to rescue his people out of Egypt, and he was finally going to fulfill the promises that he gave to Abraham, right? They had the pit stop at Mount Sinai to get the covenant and the law, right? And now, finally, they are about a year, right, after they have exited, my goodness, thank you, Egypt. About a year later, maybe a little over a year, they are now waiting at the edge of the promised land to go in and take over. Okay? But, so, your land, Moses, or God's land, not, we don't have anything to do with it. But they do say it is flowing with milk and honey, right? And they show the fruit. Okay, so they start with the good, but the good gets one verse. The bad gets, I guess, only two, but they're longer. Exactly. Nevertheless, and Marian's version said, however, okay, and this is the rebellion, right? Quickly, the bad news comes, and this overshadows any of the good. Okay, this is the major turning point in Numbers. Because of this nevertheless, and because the entire nation went along with this nevertheless, right? Therefore, we get the book of Numbers, right? Because theoretically, the book of Joshua should have started right here. I mean, and it wouldn't have been called Joshua because he wouldn't have been the leader. But theoretically, the conquest of the land should have started right after the spies bring their report back. Hey, this is the best place to attack first. You know, the land's great. Let's go. We'll start tomorrow or next week, whatever. Okay? But because of this, nevertheless, they are going to be doomed to wander and die. Okay? It says, nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong. In the Hebrew, the strong is emphasized. It's first. Literally, it says, nevertheless, strong are the people who live in the land. Okay, so the emphasis is on the strength of the people. Then it says, and the cities are fortified and very large. So the cities seem impregnable, right? And then scariest of all, there are giants in the land. Okay, moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Okay, and remember, we talked about last time how they were very tall and how Joshua drives them out of everywhere except for some of the Philistine cities. Gath is one of them, and that's why people think that maybe Goliath was a descendant of Anak. Okay, it doesn't say that in the Bible, but it does say that there were Anakim in Gath, and Goliath comes from Gath. So, okay. Then, this is what's funny. Then, verse 29, he says, they say, Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea, by the side of the Jordan. Okay, so they're not only afraid of the Anakim, they are afraid of everybody. The Amalekites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, and the Canaanites. It's almost as if they walk into the land and they're surprised to find people there. They're surprised to find people living there, and they're like, we can't do this. There are all these scary people here. Okay? What's really ironic is, let's go back to Exodus 3. Can someone read for me Exodus 3, verse 8? Okay, so God says, I'm going to take you out of Egypt, take you to a great land. Oh, and by the way, there are all these people living there.
Right.
OK, Okay? Let's go to Exodus 13, verse 5.
And when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, you shall keep this service in this month.
Okay, so, oh, I'm going to give you this land. By the way, there are people there. Exodus 33, verse 2 and 3. Exodus 33, verse 2 and 3. Okay, so this is Exodus 33, right? Is right after Exodus 32, which is the golden calf. Okay, so God's angry here. But still, he says, I will send my angel before you. By the way, there are people in the land, and I'm going to drive them out. Okay, even my angel is going to drive him out because I'm mad at you. Okay, so every time God has talked about the promised land, right? He said, there's people in the land, and I'm still going to give it to you. So the spies come back with their report. They're like, ah, there are people in the land. They're scary people. They're giants, and they're scary, and their cities are large and fortified. And it's like, God already said that, right? That shouldn't have been a surprise, okay? Now, I understand maybe they're bigger than you thought or more impressive than you thought, right? But it's God versus the Canaanites, okay? So it still shouldn't, it should not have been a surprise that there are people in the land. And God has said over and over, I'm going to drive them out. There are people there, but I'm still going to give you this land. Okay, he's going to help them conquer it. God has never said, I'm going to give you this land, but by the way, there are all these people there and you just have to figure out the best way to get them out. Okay, he's never said that. Verse 30, then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. Okay, so Caleb speaks out against this report. He is confident, he has faith, that with God's help they can conquer. Okay, for we, you know, he doesn't specifically appeal to God here, but that's he has confidence because that is what God said is going to happen. That they can conquer because God is going to be with them and help them conquer. Okay, because of this act of faith right here, right? This one choice he made to stand up alone, right? It doesn't even say Joshua was with him. Now, Joshua gets to enter the land too, right? So obviously Joshua supported him, but at least in scripture, it's not recorded here that Joshua speaks out. So Caleb is bold enough to stand up all by himself against everybody else, right? And for this act of faith, he is allowed to enter the land. Okay? And he is going to get a special inheritance. Let's go to Joshua 14. Can someone read for me verses 6 through 15? Joshua 14, 6 through 15.
Then the people of Judah came to Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, you know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, in Kadesh Barnea, concerning you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought him word again as it was in my heart. But my brothers who went up with me made the heart of the people melt. Yet I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses swore on that day, saying, surely the land on which your foot has trodden shall be an inheritance for you and your children forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord my God. And now behold, the Lord has kept me alive, just as he said. These 45 years since the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses while Israel walked in the wilderness. And now behold, I am this day 85 years old. I am still as strong today as I was in the day that Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then, for war and for going and coming. So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day, for you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out just as the Lord said.
Keep going through 14.
Then Joshua blessed him, and he gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, for an inheritance. And therefore Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and the Kenizzite to this day. because he wholly followed the Lord, the God of Israel.
Okay, so everyone's afraid of Hebron because that's where the Anakim are, and they're all big and scary, right? And for Caleb's act of obedience, because he spoke the truth against all the lies of the majority, right? They were afraid. He trusted the Lord. He gets the very, as his inheritance, the land, the scary land, right? And God helps him drive out the Anakim, and he gets that as his inheritance, okay? And he's 85 years old when he does it, right? But God kept him, right? Sustained him through the 40 years of wandering and then 5-6 years of conquest, right? This is part of the conquest. And he, right, God does exactly what he said he would do. Okay. Verse 31, back to Numbers 13, verse 31. But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong with us." Okay, so Caleb is outnumbered by the 10 and shot down immediately. And it's interesting. It's Caleb said, "We should by all means go up." And the men, the 10, say, "We are not able to go up." So they directly contradict him, almost using his exact words and just twisting them around. Okay. It says, verse 32, so they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out. It can also be translated an evil report. Okay, their words are untrue. They spread fear in Israel is what they're doing. Okay, they're saying the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. Okay, now not just the Anakim are giants, now everybody's a giant. Okay, all of them. And the land devours its inhabitants. They're saying you live there and the land just kills you. Okay, but earlier they did say that it was a land flowing of milk and honey. Okay, so now they are so afraid that fear just begets fear, right? And the giants in their minds now become not just Anakim, but now everybody. Okay.
Ironically, later on, the earth does literally swallow up some of them, the Kohathites.
Yes, that's true. That is very
true. In the wilderness that they're living in.
That's very true. That's very true. Okay. So they are challenging God who promised them the land. Okay, and remember, you guys got to remember, what army did God already conquer for them? The Egyptian army, which was the world, I mean, the Egyptian army was far greater than any Canaanite, Amorite, whatever, Jebusite army in Canaan. And so God had already conquered the world's greatest army, and now they're in the land, and they're afraid that they won't be able, that God will not be able to conquer these people.
All the best soldiers and all the best chariots with the bottom of the sea.
Exactly, exactly. That's right. That's right. Okay, so they have no trust in God's power to fight for them. Okay, this was a quote from one of my commentaries. He said, "Focusing fearfully upon the outward feasibility in the face of the world's power rather than upon their inward faith in God's omnipotence, they lost perspective of the boundless possibilities that awaited them." So they focused only on what they could see and not on the promises of God, and they were fearful, and it turned everybody into a giant. Okay, then it says, verse 33, "There also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, so we were in their sight." Anyone remember who the Nephilim are? Yes, and who were they? They were the produce, right, of the angels and the women, okay? And they produced Nephilim, who were great warriors or whatever in the land, okay? So they are so afraid that they think that they compare the Anakim to the Nephilim. I mean, these are how bad these people are. They're as scary as those people back from Genesis 6. Okay? And so much so that they think that they are grasshoppers, right? They think the Anakim view them as grasshoppers. They view themselves as grasshoppers. There's nothing that they can do against these people.
But they didn't see them. I mean, the Anakim didn't see them. Did they? I mean, it says, and so we were in their sight.
I mean, the Anakim might have seen them. I don't know that they would have necessarily known that they were there spying out the land. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not so. Yes. But again, they also said the land devours the people and that all of them were giants. Okay, so everything is greatly exaggerated because they are so afraid. Okay. But the truth is that their fear is really an abandonment and rejection of God and his promises. Okay. They are not remembering what God has said. They are not trusting what God has said, and they are focusing only what they can see and what they think they can do in their own power. So this is an absolute rejection of God and his promises, and it just gets worse in chapter 14. Questions, chapter 13. Okay, so chapter 14 really is just a continuation of the story. Can someone read for me verses 1 through 10a? So just the first sentence in chapter 10. 1 through 10a.
Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." But all the congregation said to stone them with stones.
Okay. So, this is the climax of the rebellion, right? Because at least in chapter 13, it's only the 10 spies. So, theoretically, right, Israel as a whole could say, no, we're going to side with Moses and Caleb. Caleb and Joshua, right? Caleb brings back a good report, so we can do this. Theoretically, that could have happened. Okay. But Israel does not listen to Caleb or Moses or Joshua. They listen to the 10. Okay, so.
Surprised Aaron didn't go
weak-kneed
on this one, too.
Oh, yeah. I thought you were going to say you're surprised Aaron didn't speak up. And
learning his lesson of Miriam.
That's what I was
maybe.
Thinking.
Yeah, right, because Miriam was just chapter 12. Oh, man.
He might be at least holding his tongue, not necessarily.
Yeah. And they aren't approaching him. If Moses does something, at least he has someone to do it with. Right? Because with the golden calf, Moses was up the mountain, and they approach him. And with Miriam, she, I'm sure, drug him into it, too. So, I don't know. Poor Aaron. He struggled. Okay. All right. Verse 14, verse 1, then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. Okay, so all of Israel is persuaded by the 10. Fear and frenzy spread. Okay. In Hebrew, there are two phrases for lifting up your voice in lamentation or mourning. Both are used here in verse 1 to emphasize this is just over the top. Okay, over the top mourning. They think that they are at death's doorstep and they are just going to be slaughtered. Okay. And verse 2, all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. So they are rebelling against God and his appointed leaders. In their eyes, Moses, and by extension God, had failed, right? And they need to be replaced, right? They're ready to pick new leaders. Get rid of Moses and Aaron and let's start over again. Okay, second half, verse 2, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in the wilderness?
I want to slap them and let's go back to Egypt.
Okay.
Right. In their minds, any evil fate they could have suffered would have been better than this. Okay. death in slavery or death in the wilderness was preferable to the promised land. This is case in point. Be careful what you wish for because you just might get it. Right? Okay. Now, remember, this is the whole reason they left Egypt, was to come claim the promised land. That was the whole purpose. Now they're ready to throw in the towel and return to slavery. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Right? Verse 4, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. Forget Moses. He led us out of Egypt. You have to remember, they didn't like Moses from the start. One, Moses didn't want to be their leader from the start. Two, they didn't like Moses from the start, right? Because Moses comes, starts poking his nose in, and things just get worse. So I don't know if there was ever a super great relationship between Moses and the people. Maybe at times, right? But they seem to complain about Moses a lot, really because they're rebelling against God, and Moses is the stand-in for God. Okay? But they are ready to depose Moses and head back to Egypt. They're focusing again only on their outward situation. Verse 3, right? They're afraid for their wives and children that they're going to become plunder or die, right? Fall by the sword. So they are viewing the God of life as the God of death, right? Even though God has done everything to preserve their life, right, through this whole process, right? Even during the 10 plagues in Egypt, even through crossing the Red Sea, even through the wilderness journey to Sinai, and even journey to Canaan. God has done everything to preserve their lives. Right. That's right. Well, and there were many judgments where people died. But as a whole, he preserved the life of the nation. Okay. And Israel is specifically afraid for their little ones. Why is that ironic? Because they're the ones that are actually going to fight the war. Okay. Their children are going to be the ones that conquer the land. Okay. So God not only preserves their children, he preserves their children and gives them the blessing that the parents theoretically should have received. Okay, so their unbelief is invalid at every point. They're afraid of everything that they should not be afraid of. Okay, verse 4, they're ready to pick a new leader and go back to Egypt, go back to their starting place, thereby completely rejecting the entire plan of redemption. Okay, they don't want any part to do with God. Okay, and remember the whole book of Exodus, whenever they complained, we talked about they would always basically say, we would rather be slaves in Egypt than slaves of God. God, you don't know what you're doing. It's miserable being your slave. It was better being abused by man, right, beaten, whatever, in Egypt than to be your slave, God. Okay, Israel was to be a nation of faith, right? Abraham believed and it was credited to him as righteousness. The whole story of Genesis, right, of Abraham 12 to 22 is Abraham's growth in faith, right? If you remember, he fails in chapter 12. He fails along the way, but then chapter 22 shows how much he grew in his faith when God tells him to sacrifice Isaac and he doesn't even question, okay? Hebrews tells us because he thought God could raise the dead. All right, so he had great faith. Israel is the nation God has created out of Abraham, and they are completely abandoning the way of Abraham. They have no faith. Okay. Verse 5, then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. So at least Aaron is on the right side here. Okay. They are appalled. Moses and Aaron are appalled at the rejection of God. They fall on their faces, possibly pleading with the people not to execute them, right? Because they're ready to pick a new leader, which means you're going to not just leave the old leader's font be, right? And also possibly they're pleading with God. Other places in Numbers where Moses and Aaron fall on their face, their judgment is imminent, okay? We can look at one. Can someone read Numbers 16, verse 3 and 4?
They assembled themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said to them, "You have gone too far, for all in the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? When Moses heard it, he fell on his face.
Okay, this is Korah's rebellion. This is where the ground's going to open up and swallow up people, right? Moses knows trouble's coming. Don't say those things, okay? So falling on your face for Moses, you know, he is aware the people are rejecting God and judgment is going to come, right? That was in the tabernacle. I mean, they would have been aware of it, right? Because the entire nation waits the 7 days while Miriam's outside the camp before they move. So they would have been aware of it, but they might not have actually, they wouldn't have actually witnessed it. Maybe some of the Levites would have. I don't know if all of them would have, but yes. Okay. Verse 6, Joshua, the son of Nun. So this is the first time Joshua is equated with Caleb, okay? Because in chapter 13, we only had Caleb speaking up. But here now, Joshua is aligning himself with Caleb. Not to say he didn't align himself before. It's just not recorded that Joshua said anything at that point. So Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. Okay, so we have Caleb and Joshua tearing their clothes in mourning and distress. Okay. The people want a new leader, and it's kind of ironic because Joshua is going to be that new leader, but he is not going to align himself with them in their rebellion. Okay, he's not going to lead them in their rebellion. Verse 7 through 9, Joshua and Caleb actually plead with the people. They spoke, they being Joshua and Caleb, to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to spy out is exceedingly good, is an exceedingly good land." Okay? They are trying to get the people to focus on God and the exceeding goodness of the land. But the thing is, we have four faithful leaders versus an entire nation of rebels. That exceedingly good land in the Hebrew, it's literally good is the land exceedingly, exceedingly. So they are trying to say, you think it's this so scary, giants, everyone's a giant and they're all Nephilim and the land is going to just eat us up, right? And so then Joshua and Caleb come on the other side and say, no, the land is over the top good. This is exactly what God has promised us. And it is truly a land flowing of milk and honey. Okay. Then he says in verse 8, if the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. So the point is God's going to lead them and fight for them and give them the land. The land is a gift. They don't have to worry about the inhabitants. But notice their condition, right? Verse 8, if the Lord is pleased with us, and clearly God is not pleased with their evil rebellion. Verse 9, it says, only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. Twice they say, do not fear, right? Because that is the true problem, is they are just scared. They're scared so much so that they do not have any faith. Okay? And notice it says their protection has been removed from them, talking about the Canaanites. So God is with Israel and is protecting them, and all of the Canaanites' protection has been removed. Right? So there's not even anything to be afraid of. Because if you remember, God says to Abraham, I'm going to give you the land, right? But he says, the sin of the Amorite is not yet complete. So it's not going to be now, it's going to be later, right? So if Abraham had said, no, I'm going to try to conquer the land now, right? It wouldn't have worked because the time wasn't right and the Canaanites would have still had some of God's protection because that wasn't part of his plan. Well, their sin is now complete, right? And God is bringing Israel in to conquer them partially to fulfill his promise and partially as a judgment on the Canaanites for their wicked, sinful practices, right? Their shade, that term for protection literally is shade in the Hebrew, okay? So their shade or protection has been removed. In the Bible, shade is very much peace and, you know, if you're sitting under the shade of your own vine and fig tree, right, during Solomon's reign, that's peaceful. There's peace in the land and everyone's okay. Okay. The Canaanite shade has been removed. And so God is now bringing in Israel to conquer them. So there shouldn't be nothing to fear about because God is with them and clearly not with the Canaanites.
I wonder what God would have done if they'd have crawled into the promised land like little whip puppies, you know, fearful that he wasn't going to protect them.
But still obeyed?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that he would have at least...
proven himself.
Yeah. Again, and fulfilled his promise. But, yeah, Israel wasn't one to do that. Yes. Yes, against the Amalekites. Yes. Right, and Joshua had to cobble together an army out of nothing. Yep.
And so, like, you know, now they've been together a little bit longer. They've kind of, you know, been, one would assume, you know,
right.
Building up their own military strength. They are obeying God's word, but I don't know.
Right. Yes. But, okay, but this is the point, right? Verse 10, but all the congregation said to stone them with stones, okay? Fear makes us fools, okay? And we've seen that really well. Okay, but if we choose to trust ourselves and to trust our circumstances and what we ourselves, we think we are capable of, right? Without factoring in God at all, we are gonna do this same thing where God has said, I have proved myself to you over and over and over and over again. And still you look at the circumstance and you think you can't do it and you're afraid and you choose to do what's wrong instead. So I think we are much more like the Israelites than we would care to admit. You know, and to be fair to the Israelites, we have the entire revealed word of God, right? They did not. They had this much. They had maybe the book of Job, and that was it, written down, right? Because Moses is in the process of writing the first five books of the Bible here. So they had nothing like that. Now, they had God physically with them. I mean, so they had things that we don't have, but... Also in the book of John, we've seen clearly that seeing is not believing. You have to have a changed heart. God has to change your heart to enable you to have the faith that you need to believe. Because otherwise, this is the heart of man. It doesn't matter what proof is put in front of you. It doesn't matter how many things you've experienced. You will always choose yourself instead of God. That's just the nature of man. Okay? So this is where Israel is. They are choosing to fear the world instead of believe God. So much so that they would rather kill their leaders than trust God. Yes. Right, because that's going to fix everything if the leaders are dead. Can someone read for me Numbers 35, verse 33 to 34?
You shall not pollute the land in which you live, for blood pollutes the land, and no atonement can be made for the land for the blood that is shed in it, except by the blood of the one who shed it. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell in the midst of the people of Israel.
Okay, so this is the very end of Numbers, and God is saying murder defiles the land. Okay, there has to be judges, justice. You cannot just kill people. Okay? They're not even going to take the land, but what are they choosing to do instead?
Murder.
They want it. They haven't even gotten into the land, and they're already ready to defile it, okay? Because at this point, they don't even want the land. They want nothing to do with God. They want nothing to do with the leaders. They don't even want the land, and they're ready to defile the land, okay? So this is absolute mutiny, right? Absolute rebellion. Moses, Aaron, Joshua, and Caleb are about to be killed, right? And it's 4 against 2.5 million, so what are they going to do, right? They can't do anything. Okay, so only God can fix the situation. Questions, first 10 verses.
I know that we haven't read part B yet, but this also sounds like Miriam.
Yep.
Sounds like, nope, I've had enough.
Yep, that's right. All right, can someone read 10b to verse 25 for me?
But Moses replied to the Lord, "The Egyptians will hear about it, for by your strength you brought up this people from them. They will tell it to all the inhabitants of this land. They have heard that you, Lord, are among these people, how you, Lord, are seen face to face, how your cloud stands over them, and how you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and in a pillar of fire by night. If you kill these people with a single blow, the nations that have heard your fame will declare, 'Since the Lord wasn't able to bring this people into the land, to give them, he has slaughtered them into the wilderness.'" He said, so how far?
25, please.
"So now may my Lord's power be magnified just as you have spoken. The Lord is slow to anger and rich in faithful love, forgiving wrongdoing and rebellion. But he will not leave the guilty unpunished, bringing the consequences of the father's wrongdoing on the children to the third and fourth generation. Please pardon the wrongdoing of this people, in keeping with the greatness of your faithful love, just as you have forgiven them. The Lord responded, "I have pardoned them as you requested. Yet as surely as I live, and as the whole earth is filled with the Lord's glory, none of the men who have seen my glory and the signs I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness and have tested me these 10 times did not obey me, will ever see the land I swore to give their fathers. None of those who have despised me will see it. But since my servant Caleb has a different spirit and has followed me completely, I will bring him into the land where he is gone, and his descendants will inherit him. Since the Amalekites and the Canaanites are living in the lowlands, turn back tomorrow and head for the wilderness in the direction of the Red Sea."
Okay. So God himself shows up, second half, verse 10, right? "Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel." Okay. So God intervenes because the nation is on the verge of exploding. Okay, and he is going to bring judgment, and God is angry, understandably so, right? Okay, what does this whole conversation between God and Moses remind you of?
When Abraham is living on Lot's behalf and where Lot is living.
Okay, because God was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, but think of another conversation between God and Moses that's almost identical. No.
After the calf?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to Exodus 32, verse 11 and 12. I mean, God is angry at Israel a lot, but he doesn't necessarily want to wipe them all out and start all over again often. Exodus 32, verse 11 and 12.
"Brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand. Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, 'With evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth'? Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people."
Okay, I should have had you read verse 10 too. Verse 10 says, "Now," this is God speaking, "now let me alone that my anger may burn against them, and that may I destroy them, and I will make you a great nation." Okay, so right after the golden calf incident, God is ready to wipe out all of Israel and create a new nation out of Moses. Now, after this rebellion in the land, not wanting the promised land, God is again ready to wipe out all of Israel and start again with Moses. Okay? And this really, when God intervenes, this is the point of no return. Okay? In Numbers. Up to now, they've been headed to the promised land. They're supposed to conquer the promised land. Now, from this point on, it is too late. That option is off the table. Okay? Now they're going to be doomed to wander until they die. There is no other option after this. Verse 11, God says, "How long?" twice. Right? "How long will this people serve me? And how long will they not believe in me?" Okay? God has been very patient with Israel. quote from one of my commentators. He said, eventually, God's perseverance and long-suffering nature must be balanced by his justice in the form of judgment. Right? God cannot tolerate sin forever. There will come a point of judgment, and we are at that point here in Numbers. Okay? In Scripture, seeing is never enough, right? Because he says, despite all the signs which I've performed in their midst, I mean, this generation of Israel saw more miracles than most generations, right? And I would say any, right? Until maybe the time of Christ, okay? And then the disciples might have seen more, okay? But this generation was one of Israel. Well, I don't know if they were bad. Israel had a lot of bad generations. But the ironic thing is, it's going to be their children that is one of Israel's best generations ever, okay? Because they are going to conquer the land. And maybe as a child, they might have seen some of the works of God, but they would not have had the full understanding necessarily as an adult would, okay? But it's just ironic that one of the generations that sees the most about God is the one that will not believe in him. Okay, so God's ready to wipe everyone out. Verse 13, but Moses said to the Lord. Okay, so once again, Moses intercedes for the people who, what did they just want to do to them? They were ready to stone him. Okay, you know, I think a lot of people have said, fine, God, do your best. Like, have at it. Right, but not Moses. Okay, they wanted to kill him, and still Moses stands in the gap and intercedes for the people.
Do you think if he didn't intercede, that would have been counted as a sin?
I don't know. I mean, it is Moses' job as the leader to intercede for the people.
Right.
And if you remember, not very many chapters ago, a burden he was complaining about, right? Because the burden was too great. Yes, right.
At the same time, he also had that simple heart too. But
right. But he at least knows his job well enough that he does what is right. I mean, and he intercedes for the people. And I think part of his intercession for the people is not necessarily so much compassion for them as it is a longing for God to be glorified in the world, right? Because what's his argument? Why should God not destroy Israel?
Because people will see that he turns back on his promises.
That's right. And the world is not going to understand that God is destroying them because they are rebellious. He says they are going to think, verse 16, because the Lord could not bring this people into the land. The world is going to look at it and say, ugh, Yahweh's not so powerful. He brought them out. He got them through the wilderness, but then he couldn't finish the job, right? And so since God couldn't do it, he just decided to wipe them all out. So Moses is concerned with God's reputation. And this is the same argument that he used back in Exodus 32 that we read. What would the Egyptians think? And he starts with the Egyptians. What will the Egyptians think? You decimated them. You decimated their army, but you're not strong enough, God, to get them into the land. That's what people are going to think. Okay. And it says, if you look at verse 14, middle of verse 14, they have heard, being the Egyptians and everybody else, that you, O Lord, are in their midst, seen eye to eye. You go before them in a pillar. So God has so closely aligned himself with Israel that Israel has to succeed because God's reputation is so intertwined with them. Okay? God has aligned himself so closely with them that if anything happens to them, it's going to be the world is going to immediately blame God. Okay. So his plea really really doesn't have anything to do with the people, and it has everything to do with God. Mm-hmm. saying, God, you have aligned yourself so closely with them that if you destroy them, the nations will defame your name. They will think poorly of you. Okay. Then, verse 17 to 19, but now I pray, let the power of the Lord be great, just as you've declared. The Lord is slow to anger, abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression. But he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations. Where have we heard that before?
Moses has already said that. I just don't
know. Okay, Moses didn't say it. Who said it?
In the New Testament.
Nope.
No?
I mean, it might be, but it's repeated, it's quoted. We've heard it. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Exodus 34. The Lord, compassionate and gracious. Okay. Can someone read for me verses 6 and 7?
And the Lord passed by in front of him and proclaimed, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin. Yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations.
Okay, this is when Moses asked God, right, that he could see him. And this is when Moses has broken the tablets and now they have to be replaced, okay? And it is God who says this. Okay, God is the one who is telling Moses what he is like. Now, we skip forward to Numbers 14, and who is saying it?
Moses.
He's saying, God, this is who you told me you were. And he is using God's very words back to God. So God, Moses intimately knows God. And knows his justice and mercy have to be in balance, right? He says you're slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, but he doesn't leave out the end, right? Where will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers. So Moses understands there has to be judgment. The thing is, Moses is saying, please don't wipe out the entire nation. Wipe out those who are responsible for starting the whole thing. Okay, I'm not, you know... It's not like Moses is saying, God, you shouldn't bring any judgment at all. He's just saying, please don't just wipe out everybody. Okay? Which, now, everybody sinned, right? Because the whole nation was caught up in this rebellion, but it was started by a group of people. Okay?
That's kind of what he did with the quail, right? He didn't.
Yes.
Out everybody with the quail.
Right.
Right. Craving.
Yes. Who were the guilt, the greedy ones, right? Verse 19, pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of your loving kindness, just as you also have forgiven this people from Egypt and even until now. So Moses is saying, God, you have done this before many times, right? And there have been lots of opportunities. Israel's a pain in the neck, okay? But please, can you forgive them one more time? And forgive them not by not punishing them, right, but forgive them in the point that you're not just going to kill them all. Okay. Verse 20 and 23 to 23. So the Lord said, I have pardoned them according to your word. Okay, so God once again yields and responds favorably to Moses' plea. Okay, and just notice, God, Moses' plea, like I said before, is not based on the people or have compassion or pity. It is based on who God is, his attributes, and what he desires for himself, right? That his glory and, verse 21, but indeed as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. And that is the point. All the earth is going to be filled with the glory of the Lord. And Moses is saying, God, you're not going to get much glory if the nations think that you couldn't do it, because you're not strong enough to bring the people into the land.
Deuteronomy 5:9 is the verse I was thinking.
Okay, but is it similar?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except it says of those who hate
me. Yeah, okay. Okay, so God responds favorably to Moses and All it means is that Israel will not be totally annihilated. Okay? The 10 are still going to be judged, and the entire generation is going to get judgment. They're just not going to be, the entire nation is not going to be annihilated. Okay? So, verse 21, God's glory is going to fill all the earth. God's plan from the beginning of redemption and holiness is for the entire world, not just Israel. Okay? All the earth, not just Canaan, or not just where Israel is, the nation, all the earth. Okay? It says, and as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. This should remind us back to Genesis 1, where the commandment to man was to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Right? And that is one way God has filled the earth with his glory, is because we are all image bearers. Right? Throughout the whole world. And that is God's agenda from the beginning. Now, we are poor image bearers a lot of the time, right? Most people don't even know they're image bearers, okay? But there will come a day when every knee will bow and he will get his glory from the whole world. Okay? Verse 22 says, surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land. Okay, 10 times, that's not necessarily a literal if you go back and count. I didn't, but I don't think if you go back and count, there's literally 10. It just means over and over and over and over. It's very consistent, right? They have not changed from the beginning till now. It's no different. They still do the same thing. Okay, so you don't want the land. You think the land's going to devour you. You think the nations in the land are going to kill you. Fine. You don't get the land. Okay, so they are not going to get the land. God is giving them what he wants. This is God's judgment. So this whole generation is going to die. And this is the highest offense. They are to be a nation that believes, but they don't. And God is willing to kill an entire generation to show how holy he is. So he's not going to wipe out the entire nation, but he is going to wipe out an entire generation. Okay. Verse 24. But my servant Caleb... And we find out later Joshua too, but here it says only Caleb. Because he has had a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it. Okay, so only Caleb is allowed into the promised land, and Caleb is also called my servant, which is not used very frequently in scripture. Abraham was called my servant, Moses is called my servant, and here Caleb is called my servant. Okay. A true servant of God is one who believes in God and trusts his word implicitly, and who carries out the will of God even in the face of a world that denies and defies him, right? So Caleb is God's servant because he stood up all by himself. We have the song, Dare to be a Daniel, right? Dare to stand alone. Well, basically, dare to be a Caleb, dare to stand alone. Same thing, right? And God honors him for it. Then God says in verse 25, now the Amalekites and the Canaanites live in the valleys. Turn tomorrow and set out to the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. What is God saying? To where?
To the Red Sea.
Yes, and what does the Red Sea remind us of? Yeah, in Egypt. Fine, you wanted to die in the wilderness? You wanted to die in Egypt? Go back. Turn around and go back exactly the way you came, by the way of the Red Sea. Okay? The Amalekites and the Canaanites are in the valley. You can't go north anymore because that's their land now because you didn't want it. So you turn back and you go back to the place you wanted to be, the wilderness and Egypt.
See, you split the Red Sea on your
own. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So God is giving them what they want. The punishment fits the crime. Okay? They wanted to die in the wilderness in Egypt, so God says, fine, that's what's going to happen. You're going to die in the wilderness. What's going to happen? Questions through verse 25. Can someone read for me verses 26 to 38?
Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron. How long must I endure this evil community that keeps complaining about me? I've heard the Israelites' complaints that they make against me. Tell them, as surely as I live, this is the Lord's declaration. I will do to you exactly as I heard you say. Your corpses will fall in this wilderness. All of you who were registered in the census, the entire number of you 20 years old or more, because you have complained about me. I swear that none of you will enter the land I promise to settle you in, except Caleb, son of Jephunneh. It's all split up. Mm-hmm. It's all the end. Joshua, son of Nun. I will bring your children, whom you said you would become plunder, into the land you rejected, and they will enjoy it. But as for you, your corpses will fall in this wilderness. Your children will be shepherds in the wilderness for 40 years and bear the penalty of your acts of unfaithfulness to all your corpses lie scattered in the wilderness. You will bear the consequences of your sin 40 years based on the number of 40 days that you scattered in the land, a year for each day. You will know my displeasure. I, Yahweh, have spoken. I swear that I will do this to the entire evil community that has conspired against me. Then I will come to an end. They will come to an end in the wilderness, and there they will die. So the men Moses sent to scout out in the land, who returned and incited the entire community to complain about him by spreading a negative report about the land. Those men who spread the negative report about the land were struck down by the Lord. Only Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, remained alive with those men who went out to scout the land.
Okay, so this is... Yes, doesn't matter. Doesn't
Joshua.
Matter.
Just Joshua. We don't need his mom.
Yeah, there. His dad, yeah. Okay, so this is God speaking to Moses and Aaron and giving more details on Israel's punishment. So verse 20, okay, so how long shall I bear with this evil congregation or grumbling against me? I've heard the complaints of the sons of Israel which they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord. Just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. So God, as I live, God is swearing by himself. Emphasis, this is a done deal. There's no going back. As I live, this is going to happen. Okay? The contrast is between God, the source of life, and Israel, who's going to die in the wilderness. Four times it says, right? Verse 29, your corpses will fall in the wilderness. 31, your corpses will fall in the wilderness. 33, your corpses lie in the wilderness. 35, in the wilderness they shall be destroyed, and there they will die. Okay? So as God lives, he's swearing by himself, you are dead. You're a dead man. Yeah. Okay? And notice, it says, verse 29, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. So this is specifically against the census men. So some commentators think the Levites are left out of this. Because if you remember, the Levites were not counted in that census of 20 years old and older for the military. Now, doesn't mean the Levites are perfect. Chapter 16, we get the rebellion of Korah. And a bunch of them die anyway too. Okay, so I'm not 100% sure. But from this, it seems like the Levites would have been left out of it. So they might have, more of that generation from the Levites might have gotten to enter the land, but I'm sure a bunch of them died too as well. Okay. But if you remember, that census was for those able for military service, right? And it was supposed to be that military that went in to conquer the land. Well, they refused the land, so it is going, God's going to wipe out that military. Okay. So Israel has rejected the way of life, which is God's way, and chosen the way of death. So God gives it to them. It's ironic because they thought that God's way was the way of death. They were sure if they enter the land, they're going to die, mm-hmm. Right? Again, fear makes you foolish. You think God's way is the way of death. You think you're going to go your own way. Your own way is always the way of death, always. So God gives them what they want. Okay. Verse 30, two key exceptions, Caleb and Joshua. Okay, we've read about Caleb's inheritance, Joshua's inheritance. Can we go to Joshua 24? Joshua 24, verse 29 and 30. Yeah, Joshua 24, 29 and 30.
after these things, Joshua the son of Nun and the servant of the Lord died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in his own inheritance at Timnath-Serah, which is in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gash.
Okay, so God, they both, Caleb and Joshua, got an inheritance in the land, just like God said they would. Okay. Verse 31, it says, "Your children, however, whom you said would become prey, I will bring them in, and they will know the land which you have rejected. But as for you, your corpses will fall in the wilderness. Your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they will suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the wilderness." Okay, so the children that they're so worried about protecting, they are the ones that are going to get the land. They are also going to have to bear the punishment of their fathers, right? They're going to have to suffer in the wilderness for 40 years because their fathers sinned and they're waiting around till their parents all die off, okay? And that word for unfaithfulness, it's literally fornications. They're going to suffer for your fornications, which often sin in the Old Testament is compared to adultery or fornication against God. Okay? But they are going to eventually get the land. Verse 34, again, God says the number of your days that you spied out the land is going to be your number of wandering, years of wandering. So a year of wandering for every day in the land, 40 years. And this is the scariest part, I thought. According to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days for every day you shall bear your guilt, a year, even 40 years, and you will know my opposition. God is now against Israel. If God is for you, who can be against you? If God is against you, you're done. Who can be for you? It doesn't even matter. Nope. Okay, even the weakest foe can defeat them now. Right? No one can be for you. You're done. If God is against you, it's over. You just roll over and die because there's nothing you can do. Okay? Okay, 36 to 38, this is where God brings specific judgment, right? The 10 spies receive immediate judgment. They die on a plague that God made just for them. Okay, specific plague just for the 10 because they are the ones that started the bad report, the evil report that spread among the people. All the people are going to pay, but the 10 get immediate judgment. Questions?
Not a question as much as I just looked back to see where what tribe Caleb mm-hmm. and Joshua were from, and Caleb is from Judah.
Yes, Caleb is from Judah.
Interesting, yes. You know, because yeah. I mean, now God's preserving Judah, the line of Judah.
Right. I asked if Judah was in the line of Christ. I asked Kyle, and he said he didn't think so. But yes, Caleb is from the line of Judah. But then Joshua, who is going to be the leader, he is from Ephraim. Right. So, but yep. Any other questions or comments?
That's a lot of people to be dying in 40
years.
Yes. Not that 600,000.
Yes. Right. Plus, you would assume, yeah, their wives as well. Right. Yeah.
They buried them or they just leave them?
I'm sure they. What I'd heard one, I'm not sure how true this is, but for the 40 years wandering, they thought they would just camp somewhere until the graveyard, you know, until they couldn't bury any more people. Then they move on, camp somewhere until they couldn't bury any more people. Because they would have just been dropping like flies. And God brought specific judgments that killed masses of them at a time. So this isn't necessarily, you know, you're just going to grow old in the desert and die. No. Yeah.
Yeah. People still lived longer back.
Right. I mean, 40 years. And if you're 20, the longest you could live is till 60. And that wasn't even guaranteed, you know.
Didn't they call Jesus the Lion of the Tribe of Judah?
Yes.
So that's what I guess, so who are you saying?
Well, Judah is going to have way more than one line that you can come through.
So you're saying just the directness.
Yes, I'm saying that I don't know that Caleb is a direct ancestor of Jesus.
Right.
No, Jesus was from Judah, yes. Right. But Judah had Perez and Zerah.
You're just in the sense of coming from Caleb.
Yes.
Line up Judah.
Yes. Yes.
There, that's what I was confused. I was like, I thought Christ came through the line of
Oh, he does. Sorry. He does. I meant, I don't know if Caleb is a direct ancestor of Christ, like in the genealogy.
But it's just in this idea of him wiping out the nations, those generations, he was preserving the nations of Judah.
Right. Well, and you can see Judah is continuing to be a leader.
Right.
Yes.
Luke has the line of Christ's genealogy.
And so does Matthew. That's not going to be the same Joshua.
But there is Simeon, son of Judah.
It's funny how...
There's a couple son of Judahs.
Yeah. So, I mean, it'll come through the line.
Either, though, correct?
Well, there are two. So there's one in Luke and one in Matthew. And I don't remember which one's which. One's Mary's, one's Joseph's. And they're both from Judah. One's the kingly line and one's the not. The kingly line is going to be Joseph's.
It's just interesting how...
But yes, Judah is going, because the seed is going to come through Judah, Judah is going to always be specifically spared.
And then the other one is from Ephraim, which was Joseph, and Joseph was one of the only ones who trusted God.
Right, right, yeah. Yep.
And trusted his plan, regardless of what happened to him.
Right. Yep. All right. Let's finish. This last bit should be quick. Can someone read 39 to 45?
When Moses told these words to all the people of Israel, the people mourned greatly, and they rose early in the morning and went up to the heights of the hill country, saying, "Here we are. We will go up to the place that the Lord has promised, for we have sinned." But Moses said, "Why now are you transgressing the command of the Lord, when that will not succeed? Do not go up, for the Lord is not among you, lest you be struck down before your enemies. For there the Amalekites and the Canaanites are facing you, and you shall fall by the sword, because you have turned back from following the Lord. The Lord will not be with you." But they presumed to go up to the heights of the hill country, although neither the ark of the covenant of the Lord, nor Moses, departed out of the camp. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in the hill country came down and defeated them and pursued them even to Hormah.
Okay, so Israel.
Did they not just say the 10 men? They have immediate judgment.
They cannot obey. Okay, so verse 39, they respond in great mourning at the pronouncement of judgment. Okay. They have great sorrow, but they are still rebellious of heart. Okay? They think that they can apologize and say, "My bad," and move on with the original plan, and everything's going to be okay. That's right. That's exactly right. Okay? So, consequences for sin do not always make this possible, that you can just apologize and move forward with the original plan, okay? They are sorry, but they have a worldly grief, right? They're sorry they got caught. They're sorry they're going to be punished. They don't really have a change of heart. And you can see that because they still don't obey. Okay, God through Moses clearly says no. So they say, "Hey, God, sorry, we're going to go attack the land now." Yep. Moses says, "Oh, no, you're not." God has said no. He says, "Why are you transgressing the commandment?" That's literally mouth of the Lord. It will not succeed. Do not go up. Okay, you cannot be clearer. 13 verse 17 and 13 verse 30, it says, "Go up into the land, go up, go up." Now Moses is saying clearly, do not go up. Okay? God is not with them, so they will be defeated. And he says that, or you will be struck down. Okay? And why? Because they have turned back from following the Lord. The Lord will not be with you. But they went up heedlessly. Okay, Israel is still in a state of rebellion. God had commanded them, right? Verse 25. Turn tomorrow. Yes. Right? As he said, turn tomorrow and set out to the wilderness. So they were to turn around and head back into the wilderness. Look at verse 40. In the morning, it's tomorrow. God has given you your marching orders. You're to turn around, go to the wilderness. And instead of on tomorrow, they're like, "We're going to go attack." Okay, not a good idea. One of my commentators said, Israel still does not take God seriously or listen to Moses, his appointed representative. Okay? They think God will be satisfied if they, quote unquote, obey late. Right? As parents, what do we say? Delayed obedience is not obedience?
Obedience.
Yes. And it's clear, Moses and the ark do not go with them. Okay? End of verse 44. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and struck them and beat them down as far as Hormah. Okay, so they are thoroughly defeated. All their fears of fighting have come true. They can't stand up against the giants of the land, and these aren't even the giants. Okay? Because they are not in obedience to the Lord. Okay? One of my commentators said, sometimes the consequences of sin and rebellion are irreversible, and one must endure the experience of God's judgment before a new course of action brings blessing. It was too late. You cannot just say, oh, that was a bad road. Let's just try again. Sometimes you don't get a do-over. Now, they could have really repented in their heart and taken their punishment and died in the wilderness and gone to heaven, right? That was an option. But instead, they just rebel even from God's clear command of turn around and head back into the wilderness. And instead, they try to go take the land in their own strength. And like I said, if God is opposed to them, even the weakest foe is going to trounce them. Okay, that you cannot, if God is against you, no one can be for you. Questions? Let us learn from the example of the Israelites. Right, and that's what the New Testament says. These things are recorded for our learning, that we can learn for our example.